The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, everyone. It is Stephen Schleicher, and I just wanted to say I hope you're doing well again this week. Hey, listen, we just hit kind of a chapter break there in the Void Saga. If you remember from last week, the party was running away from a fight, escaping a no-win situation, and that seemed like a good place to take a break this week. In addition, here in the United States, it is Memorial Day weekend. Now, because of the situation that's going on across the world right now, many of you are looking for ways that you can continue your gaming sessions together at a distance. Coincidentally, last month on the GM Roundtable, we talked about how to take your game online. And I know what you're thinking. Hey, what the heck is the GM Roundtable? Well, the GM Roundtable is a monthly discussion with our patrons over at patreon.com/majorspoilers, silver level and higher, where they kind of pick a topic. And for that show for the month, we sit around and talk about tips, techniques, and ways that you can make your game mastering a heck of a lot better. So this week, because we're on that chapter break, and because of the holiday weekend, and because I want to give everyone a little taste of what the GM Roundtable is, and to help you out in your own game sessions, this week we are releasing the Game Masters Roundtable Episode 5, Taking Your Game Online, to you for free. You don't have to pay for it. It's coming up here in just a few minutes. And you may be saying, wait, there's 5 episodes? No, there's actually 6 episodes, because just this week we recorded our 6th episode of the GM Roundtable. And next month we'll do another live recording of the GM Roundtable for everyone. And if you would like to get in on that, then all you need to do is point your browser to patreon.com/majorspoilers. So, hopefully you enjoy this. If you get something out of it, please let us know by messaging us at Major Spoilers on Twitter or using the hashtag Critical Hit. We'd certainly appreciate getting some feedback from the general audience. And if you want to participate, if you want to join in, and if you want to get more, just go check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information, and check out some of the other free stuff that we have over there waiting for you. So here you go. Here is the GM Roundtable. Have your friends moved away? Can't make it to game night but still want to play? Taking your role-playing game online has become a big deal in the last several years, but GMs are still struggling to have a successful campaign. This month on the GM Roundtable, we'll be tackling the problems and the successes of taking your game virtual. I'm Stephen Schleicher. Thank you for joining us this week on the GM Roundtable. And our panelists once again this week include Samantha. Hello, Samantha.
Hello.
Rob is also here. Hello, Robert.
Hi-o.
D&D Brian, what's going on?
Oh, it's going.
Rodrigo is here.
Hey.
And Matthew is here as well.
Mina, konbanwa.
So we have an interesting setup because we have been doing the Critical Hit podcast as basically virtual gaming since the very beginning, because not all the players have ever been at the table at the same time. And now, over the course of 10, 12 years, there's nobody at the table. In fact, everybody is virtual. So we've got some experiences, and we have some things that we believe work and some things that we believe don't work when it comes to setting up a game virtually. But Rodrigo, let's begin with you, and let's talk about some of the logistics of playing the game online versus playing the game system.
So when you're getting ready to start an online game, you really need to consider what a session entails and what the game wants. If the game uses miniatures, you have to take that into account. If the game uses cards, you have to take that into account. If the game doesn't care about any sort of like physical space, that's probably going to be helpful. But you'd be surprised as you start playing that there might be things that you didn't think about. So it definitely helps to think ahead of time of what it is that the game calls for, how you normally play it, and what sort of actual spatial movement is necessary. And start basically shopping around for systems that are going to either allow you to do that, or by which I mean a way of communicating remotely that is either going to allow you to do that or finding ways to patch that out of the game.
Sure. Now, one of the earliest forms of doing role-playing games remotely is through play-by-post, which has been a big popular aspect of gaming since the early, you know, Rec Arts RPGs yeah. dot Dungeons and Dragons dot play here dot coms days. And even when we had the forums over at Major Spoilers, we had a very active play-by-post experience going on. Matthew, you've probably had more experience with play-by-post than most. What are some experiences that you've had with play-by-post, and does that work or does it not work?
It works, but a play-by-post game and an RPG played at a table with live people are completely different beasts. It's the difference between, you know, going to a Rolling Stones concert and Rolling Stones in your backyard. They have the same name, but that's really the only, you know, coherent thought process that's the same. One thing that you find in a play-by-post game that can be really troublesome is kind of the perception of granular time. I used to do play-by-post. We would do RPG wrestling games. We would actually have the physical game on the N64, but then we would role-play all of the other stuff in the forums. And part of the response and part of who won and who lost was actually based on your role play. And you would get guys who would get super granular and would go through, you know, you would post something and say, this is my promo or this is what happens. And they would go through line by line and respond line by line in a way that is not legitimately physically possible if you were playing face to face. So you have, you know, there are differences in the perception of time. There are differences in if I put something in, say it's Tuesday night for me, I put in something and someone on a completely different timeline doesn't come in until Friday.
Yeah, the asynchronous aspect exactly. of play by post seems to be the most frustrating for a lot
Absolutely.
Of people.
Because you'll have people on Friday who want to respond to what I said on Tuesday, but unfortunately Wednesday and Thursday, Rob and Brian have already been involved. The game has moved on from that point. If Rodrigo comes in on Friday, you still have to deal with the fact of, as far as he's concerned, that's the newest information. And I feel like the play-by-post experiences that I've had were mostly positive, but were also very frustrating in ways that a face-to-face or even the remote gaming that we do on Critical Hit will never be.
Yeah. So when it comes going, and so combining both of these together, both the play-by-post experience where, again, most of it is descriptions and there's very little extra material, and then looking at something like what we do with Critical Hit, as Rodrigo was explaining, knowing what the logistics are. Sam, what are some of the physical things that you need to have when you're taking your game online? What are some of those considerations?
So it depends a bit on what some of the things Rodrigo was saying. Like if you're not playing a game that involves a lot of, you know, like that where you need any type of physical grid, or if you're using a tool like Roll20, you really just need to worry about your audio setup. In which case, you know, people can get away with having it on their laptops, but I actually recommend, especially if you have, say, like one group that's meeting in person and one group that's outside, having a separate mic because it'll provide better sound. Because you're going to get reverb if you have, say, two people who are on their laptops. You can't have both of them be doing the audio at once, and so then one person's going to be really soft. So I like having like a centralized microphone device that can be between all the people who are in one setting, so it's picking up their voices equally. And then if you're do care about visuals, I also recommend having a webcam, which you can set up to show, depending on like the session, you can have it be looking at the players' faces, or like so you can see each other's faces for social scenes, or you can have it pointed at like the grid or your map or whatever physical setup you have. If you're doing a thing where people kind of need to see where their characters are in position. I also love, when possible, to have a setup where you can have your people's faces showing up on a separate screen, because if you're using, say, your laptops to manage your character sheet, that way you can see people's faces but still also be looking at your tools as opposed to having to tab between them.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things that we've done over the years is I don't think we ever had a webcam on individuals' faces. Because, of course, we're telling stories and we're playing games. However, in the early days of Critical Hit, we did have a webcam that was pointed at a physical mat. Rodrigo would bring in his mat and draw things out. And then we had, when we were taking pictures of the table, I would just mount a little webcam on top of the camera pointing at the same direction. And whatever the camera, the physical digital SLR camera was seeing, that's what Matthew would be seeing on his end on Skype. And so we used that for a number of years until we made the move over to Roll20. And we really haven't used webcams since. There's a couple of issues with webcams, and it really depends on when we talk about components and requirements for gaming. One of the things that you really should take into consideration is what is your internet speed? What is your bandwidth? Because if you're going to be using a webcam and audio, and depending on what other things that you might be calling up, web pages or Roll20 stuff or other things, that's going to eat up into your bandwidth. And certainly video takes up a much bigger part or bigger chunk of that bandwidth than audio or text on a web page, HTML stuff. So that is a consideration that you probably need to keep in mind. And then, you know, the other thing that you need to kind of consider is the webcam actually necessary? Do you need to see other people's faces? Matthew, do you want to answer? You want to take on that about the need for a webcam?
Absolutely. I think that, I have always been remote on Critical Hit. And aside from, there is a sort of a getting to know you voice period, because for the longest time, I had never met any of the other players. To this day, I still haven't met Sam. And it was like 5 years before I ever met Rodrigo. But you get to a point where I agree. I don't think you need to see the faces of the players. But you also have to build in a little bit of learning time, because you have to learn what might be a vocal cue, what might be an audio cue that Steven is upset, or Rodrigo, you know, got interrupted, or Rob was starting to say something. You do have to be more aware without that access. And more importantly, when we had the webcam, I had a very, very small screen. And so there were times when I needed someone to actually reach in and physically point at, this is your miniature, or something else that will occasionally come up even now in Roll20. And Rodrigo's very good about trying to anticipate this. My colors aren't really good. My eyes are very, very old and don't function very well. So sometimes if you say to me, this is the orange one and this is the green one, I will need you to identify which is which visually. So being aware of the fact that your faraway players may not need to see your face, but they may need additional visual cues. They may need additional assistance. And it may not be just a matter of the equipment. It may be a matter of that person's ability to see or hear, or, you know, any of the other things that you need to be a part of the game. So that's something to keep in mind for long distance gaming.
Yeah. At one point, we did away with the traditional webcam. I was using one of the iMac webcams, the iCam or whatever it was called. We ditched that when one of our listeners sent us a really high-end and very expensive video conferencing system where we had, you know, that you might find in a boardroom, that had a really nice high-definition camera that we would connect to Matthew. And the nice thing about that, it was remote-controlled. So if at that point, if Matthew needed to see where he was at, we could zoom into the mat and zoom out of the mat. But at the same time, webcams under normal lighting conditions are not that great, right? They have poor contrast performance. They often have poor color performance. And so you need to do a lot of tweaking, or you need to do a lot of light manipulation to make it look good. So there may be times when you've got a white mat or a whitish mat or a gray mat or whatever it may be. And because that thing is so bright, your webcam may automatically close down that iris. And then suddenly it's very hard to see all these little black blobs all over your mat, and to know which one is your character and which one is someone else's character and which one is the enemy, so on and so forth. So webcams can be great, but you also need to be aware that there are some of those problems that need to arise. Rodrigo, do you think that you always need to see players' faces in virtual gaming?
No, I mean, we make do with Critical Hit, obviously.
Doesn't it fall out of the trees, though?
Yeah, that's a callback for all you people that have been listening for the past 1,000 or so years that we've been doing this show. So I was kind of distraught when we first started, or when it became clear that it would be harder to continue doing seeing people's faces. We were using Google Hangouts mm-hmm. there for a little bit, mm-hmm. Where we could see Matthew and Adriana, but eventually that just kind of it just became clear that it wasn't going to work, and so we just stopped. We you know, for several years now, Critical Hit has been audio only for us, and because it's a podcast, that has kind of ended up being a good thing. It certainly pushes me to do a lot more description, because if I'm being an NPC who is being in trouble and I'm like making a weird face, you know, the five of us or six of us can see the weird face, but the audience can't. Mm-hmm. So it pushes me to describe the face. It pushes me to describe things a lot more. And it pushes definitely me as a game master to request more description from other people. Mm-hmm. And also I think it pushes everyone else who wants people to understand what their character is doing to do that. And it's possible, but you have to figure it out. You have to work on it, and you have to like sort of improve your vocabulary, because a lot of the time you end up saying thingy. It's like, yeah, he's wearing a coat that has like those thingies on the shoulders that like have like hanging down thingies.
Epaulets.
And then like, yeah, epaulets. Exactly. So, you know, you have to learn what an epaulette is. You have to learn what an awning is, and you have to learn what a ranser is.
Yes. And sometimes you can use that, all the lack of visuals to your advantage, especially if you want somebody to do this. Brian, how do you, yes, exactly like that. How do you make sure that people are having a good time when you can't see the body language? One of the nice things that when it was Rob and Brian and Rodrigo and myself in a room, even when we're talking, we could do some visual cues, pointing at one another like, ooh, here's a point where you should jump in, or, you know, some other things. How do you ensure people are still having a good time when you can't see that body language?
Definitely. You're definitely relying a lot more on audible cues and voice tone and everything. You might just have to kind of check in with certain players every now and again, ones that are particularly quiet. I mean, some people are just more quiet than others. You just maybe have to check in and say, hey, what's this character doing? Again, listen to how they respond, not just what they're saying, and see if they need to be included more, see if there needs to be, you know, a different direction taken, and just kind of, feel people out. It's, you know, just one of those soft skills you kind of have to develop and exercise over time, and it's just something that kind of gets easier as you go along, but it's always going to be a challenge, especially if you're having a whole group on in an adventure. There can be a lot of crosstalk to kind of make things a little difficult if someone is kind of having less of a bad time. Like I say, just kind of go around and make check in with everyone and make sure everyone's still invested.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rodrigo.
You know, some people are a little too sensitive to what they perceive from other people. So they'll be running their game and they'll see somebody like leaning, like they have their head leaning on their hand or just like down looking at something else, and they will perceive that to be that they're bored or not paying attention, whereas that's actually not the case. So in that sense, sometimes doing things remotely and not being able to see the players can actually help basically shy game masters, or game masters who are a little bit too tense about what everybody's doing and thinking, to sort of let that go and just run the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I was reading some other GM tips the other day, and the person was like, you know, it's not your job to make sure that everyone is focused and having a good time all the time. Your job is to run the game. Yeah. But, you know, one of the things about being in front of a computer, especially if you're by yourself in a room and no one else is there, it's very easy to pick up that phone, or it's easy to start surfing the web while other things are going on. Keeping focus might be a good job of the GM. Does anyone have any suggestions on how you can make sure that people are focusing on the stuff instead of just, oh, I wandered off to go use the bathroom or and forgot to tell people, or my mind is over on Twitter or some other web space?
Just even in a face-to-face game, you're not going to be able to avoid external distractions or issues. But I think that the way to do that, and Rodrigo does it very well, is, and you do it as well, when you're moderating our discussions in the various podcasts, you will be in a discussion and then you will actually call somebody out. Not call them out, but you'll say, and you'll do that too. But how do you feel about this, Sam?
So here's the thing though. If you're going to do that, you need to be very careful in how you do it, because if someone isn't paying attention and I want to say, oh, so Rob, or so what do you think of that, Rob? Then Rob's like, oh, wait, I wasn't paying attention to that. Whereas you say, Rob, what do you think about that? Then that gives them that cue to you need to pay attention. So calling their name first and then asking the question or the statement, I think does work maybe a little bit better. Now, here's another thing that that I found out, especially in the last couple of weeks. Many people were commenting on the tense scene between Ket and Orym when they met for the first time. A lot of people enjoyed that role-playing action. But the interesting thing was Matthew and I were having a side conversation while that was going on, because I think that that added to the role-play, where I was whispering to Matthew, ooh, Orym is so mad at Ket. He wants to just punch him in the face so bad. I forget what the whole conversation was.
Secret stuff.
Yeah, it was secret stuff. But at the same time, it kind of added into some of that role play action where maybe Sakaar was still standing by because he could virtually read the room of what was going on to help make that gameplay a little more interesting or a little bit more tense. It's kind of like passing notes during gameplay, if you want to think of it that way. Rob, you were going to say something a moment ago. What you've had some instances with this, right?
I was basically going to say a lot of what Matthew said about it with you just want to make sure that you're calling on people if they're getting more quiet than normal, that you're making sure to include everybody more often is more important when you can't see exactly what's going on with everybody. Just allowing that moment of, hey, Matthew, what's going on with your character right now while these schmucks are over here doing this nonsense?
Absolutely. And something that can be an advantage in long distance gaming is that I have what they refer to in the parlance as RBF. And I will sit, and if I'm listening intently, sometimes I will look like I'm really mad, or I'll look like I'm just like ready to explode. Sometimes I'll look like I'm half asleep. All of that means that I'm listening and I'm engaged. So Rodrigo not being able to see that, the other players not being able to see me, especially if I am really irritated at a game, something that's happening in game, but it's not something that needs to come through in Sakaar or into the actual show itself, it works to my advantage because I can sit and if I have to, I can just roll my eyes and I can be fine. And that's a real positive for me because vocally speaking, I feel like I have more control of how I sound than how my face actually looks. So for me, at least, it's always a plus. When you can hear me getting upset, then you know that I'm totally upset. But there are times when I'm just like, and I will sit silently and it'll be fine and everybody will move on. And because it's not about the game, it's not something that anyone needs to address or pat me on the head. It's just me having to, you know, deal with whatever's going on in my head at that time. So
we record this game or this show live for everyone, and you're able to join us in our Discord. And we do have people in the Discord this week. For those of you who are in the Discord, I was curious, what virtual systems do you use to play your games? Is everyone using Roll20, or are people using various different things? Because one of the questions people have is, hey, what is there out there that we can play our games with? And so here are some of the ones that I've come across that you could use to play your games virtually. There's D&D Beyond. One of the nice things about D&D Beyond is it does integrate with your Twitch stream. So if you're doing a Twitch stream, you can actually have overlays for all the characters to pop up so that players, viewers who are watching can hover over the screen and they can access the character sheets for everybody in real time. There's the Dungeon Masters Guild at dmsguild.com, Fantasy Grounds, Dungeon Fog, what do we have, Map Tool, D20 Pro, Astral, and Roll20 are just some of the gaming systems that are out there for people to use. So Kevin says that he uses Roll20 in Discord for voice and video chat. D&D Beyond is great for 5e, but only 5e, says Chris. So far, I've only played play by post on forums, says D. Harshman, apart from face-to-face games. So there is a kind of a broad swath. Yes,
Swathe.
Of people. Swathings. Boys,
Swayze.
Nice boys, the Roll20s and the things Swish. And the Glabins and the D&D's Beyonds.
It's a Patrick Swayze Christmas, everybody.
My pretty health. Anyway, Roll20 seems to be the one that a lot of people use because it's the one that seems to be most accessible. But Kevin did point out one of the things that I would avoid going back to webcams and voice and all that stuff. Roll20, and they even admit that their video and audio portions of the game suck, are really poor. So I would really encourage people who are using Roll20 to not use the audio or video functions of Roll20 to try and interact with each other. Instead, there are a number of other things that you can do. You can use Skype. You could use Discord. We use Skype. We did use Google Hangouts for a while, but then as we moved to separate to our current configuration, which is very complicated, that was no longer an issue. People have been using Zoom a lot lately. Somebody else I was just talking to had said that they had used Zoom for a game that they played last week and had a fine time with it. It was fine as well. But I would really stay away from Roll20 as your video and audio app. However, a lot of people have questions about Roll20, and one of the big questions is it's super powerful, but very dense and not necessarily incredibly obvious about what it can do. What are 5 hidden features everyone should know how to use? That is from Drumsticks number 1 fan asking that question. And I noticed nobody jumped in to say, ooh, let me answer this one, because there are so many, many, many hidden features. You know, there's like feature is hidden inside of a feature, hidden inside of a feature on Roll20. And unfortunately, the documentation is not great. And even if you go and find tutorials online, a lot of those were done 5 years ago, and they're not relevant to a lot of the new features that are in Roll20 today. So, Rodrigo, let us start with you. Not looking for a hidden feature, but what is one thing that you think a GM should master and know if they're going to use Roll20 to run their game?
I guess one thing that I use a lot is the fact that you can select multiple things. So if you have multiple enemy tokens or all the players, you can, for example, select all of your player tokens and then right-click them and say add turn, and then all of those will be added to the initiative track simultaneously instead of having to add each individually. One thing that you absolutely do have to master if you are running a Roll20 game is permissions. Mm-hmm. So anytime you create a character, an NPC, or even a PC where they can put in their character sheet and stuff, you need to grant people permission to alter it and to edit it and to see it. And editing it only goes to the people that have permission to edit it. So you basically pretty much have to say yes to all the edits, yes to all the seeing permissions, unless there's something specific that you want to keep hidden. And you have to do that for everything. So another thing that you can do, if you're just doing some like random MOOCs, you can move in a token, alter that one, make sure all your permissions are on, and then copy and paste it. And then everything that you paste afterwards will just carry all that stuff over, and you can alter it, change the name or whatever as you need.
Mm-hmm. Brian, beyond learning how to use layers, what's another thing that GM should know how to do inside of Roll20?
Yeah, layers can be a real pain. when things don't seem to go to the layers or go above or below when you send to the front or the back. So yeah, messing with those might be a good idea just to get a feel for that. As a GM, yeah, I think you just have to kind of figure out like the difference between using assets as like tokens or background elements. If you're using a grid, there's some way where you can have the path show up that I feel like we could probably make better advantage of, but I never remember what it is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Roll20 is interesting because, you know, it's got the fog of war. It's got light effects that you can put into it. But, you know, it's you have to do a little digging around to figure out where that is. And a lot of the stuff when you're creating your game happens in the initial setup of the game that you're creating. Like, what system are you going to use? What
choosing character sheets
that you're going to use? Those kinds of things, you know, is very useful. But it's stuff that you have to do at the very beginning. So if you create your game and then you go into the game, you're like, okay, I heard there was a thing that was going to allow me to help create characters for my players. Where is that? Oh, no, you have to go back out and then go in, figure out that character sheet, then make sure the compendium is added onto that. Then you go back into your game. Then you create a character. Then you share it with people. And then they're able to go in and create all their stuff. Once you have some of that stuff set up, though, I think that it's kind of clever, because if you do want to bring in level one orc, you just go in and find your level one orc in the compendium, and then you can drag and drop it right onto the screen with tokens and all these other things. There's plenty of add-ons that you can purchase that will work in Roll20, but those things take a little time and money to do. Sam, what are some big tips that you might have for people using Roll20?
So I really like being able to give handouts in Roll20, like being able to show people, like, whether you're giving someone like a message that they've received or like showing them a picture of something from, you know, the monster manual, your ability to, and Rodrigo's is really, really good at this too. He uses it a lot to convey notes and have like NPCs with their own little pictures. And it creates a really nice quick reference sheet for players as you're going. Another thing, like, again, it's if you can figure out how to use your system specific character sheet, it can make things really easy. Like, I've been playing a fifth ed game on Roll20 recently, and you can just like click on the character sheet, whether or not you have like advantage or disadvantage. And then when you then click on the specific roll you're making, it'll roll twice and take the worst or roll twice and take the better respectively. And that's pretty nice.
Yeah, it is kind of nice that it's built in that way. And my understanding, and I haven't, I created one character in fifth edition. Doesn't it also help you when it comes time to level up about what you can and can't add and do and that kind of stuff as well?
Not as elegantly as I want it to, but it does it to some degree.
Okay, we'll talk more about virtual character building here in just a moment. But Rob, I'm curious, in addition to sharing a useful tip on using Roll20, I've got another question for you after that.
All right. One of the bigger ones that we haven't mentioned is the pay attention to what you can do in the chat. There's a few extra random things that are very helpful. One of the bigger ones that takes me usually about half a session before I remember it exists is the whisper function. So you can speak with individual players for everything. And don't be afraid to break the system. Like, there's nothing you can do that can't be reset. To some extent, like, go in there and play with everything. That's the only way you're going to get used to it, is to futz around with stuff, go through what Roll20 has before you even create a game, see what they've got for, you know, the character sheets that were mentioned, the compendiums that were mentioned. There's character sheets in there for fan-created systems for various other things.
Oh, yeah. Like, There's a lot of systems in there, but they're not all as smooth as maybe what Wizards of the Coast has put into Roll20 or other systems as well.
They're probably not, but mostly it's because they're not being made by paid coders. Yeah, they're being made by other fans.
Yeah.
But, like, just dig into what is available before you even start, and you may be able to find so many tools that you had no idea were even a possibility that existed, and your game will just run that much smoother.
Yeah, if you're worried that you can't draw, you don't have to draw. I mean, you could spend the money and get all the parts to make all the dungeons or cities or spacescapes or whatever that you want and drag and drop and build those maps up. Matthew, before we jump into the next, do you have a suggestion on how best to use Roll20?
Well, I don't necessarily believe in best or worst. I think, like, as with so many things, it's going to be situational and it's going to be based on the needs that you have. But I feel like probably the real pro tip would be when we were doing the Weird Western and Sam would give us the grid and the board that our characters exist on, generally it would have a background that was evocative of what the actual play field was supposed to look like. So if we were fighting in the swamp, you'd see the grid, and in the background, there was a literal photograph of a swamp with the reeds and the water and the, you know, the scum and Alec Holland hiding behind a tree, all of the things that you expect from a swamp, so that you had that visual cue along with the memory of five squares over here. It kept me really focused on the role play aspect, and it was a really nice, very simple, I hope, because if she had to work and work and work at that, I feel terrible for how much we took it for granted. But
no, thank you. I'm glad you appreciated it. It was pretty easy. That was one nice thing about Roll20, is the ability to just like go on the internet and grab any picture you want and just toss it in the system and like maybe do a little bit of resizing. But it was pretty simple to find both backgrounds and icons.
Yeah, and it really, really helped to, you know, keep that role play portion of it focused. Focused is a good word that I've just made up. But it also combined in the, you know, the part of the game that I'm not always thrilled with, the actual wargaming on the grid part. And it kind of brought them together in a way that you don't always get, even when you're sitting at the same table playing together. So I felt like that's a real plus for Roll20. And I'll echo what Rob says about the whisper. I'm not like having five different whisper conversations every game, but there have been, I can think of three, four, five, right off the top of my head, five situations where the whisper completely changed what I was going to do in character because of the interactions that we had. And I feel like every one of those cases improved the scene, it improved my character, and I feel like it improved the greater narrative. So don't be afraid to collaborate or conspire or collude with the other players in the GM. And the way to do that, it's a great way to do it because you can't do it at a table. If I pass a note to Rob, Rodrigo's going to make me stand up and read it to the whole class, and he's probably going to take away my phone again.
Will you go to the prom with me, yes or no? So here's the last bit of advice I would say for both players and GMs. Learn how to use those macros. The macros are really awesome. If you're not using macros, definitely use the macros because they can make everything from simple checks to combat move much more quickly when all you have to do is just click on a button and you don't have to type /RD220 blah 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 plus K1, all that stuff. So it's really, really useful. But Rob, how would something like Roll20 work if you have two players in one location or two in another location? Do you think that each person needs to have their own laptop and Roll20? Or how do you handle the voice chat? How do you do all that stuff when you have multiple people in one location and maybe only one computer?
So I've actually had to do this the last couple of weeks as we finished up what was a live game before the world decided to come to an end. As a couple of our guys didn't actually have the ability to use Roll20 themselves, so three of us were on at one location, and then everybody else was scattered. You don't necessarily have to have a separate... I was the only one logged into Roll20 for four different characters, so I was the one controlling the characters on the board. As long as everybody can see it, we had the PC hooked up to the television, everybody could see what was going on. There was plenty. The conversation, we were fortunate enough that the house we were at does his own podcast and has four or five individual microphones and a soundboard. But you can set things up to have just a single microphone and everybody talking across that. Or the Discord phone app is actually surprisingly good. And we did have one guy who was exclusively on the phone app for communicating with us while we were controlling everything going on. You can just find a way to make things work. you might have to adjust some things from what is normal, but you don't all have to have your own thing. You don't have your own computer. You don't all have to have your own login. You can crowd a half dozen people around one screen and have the DM be somewhere else and call it good.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Is everybody ready for a super controversial topic? It's one that, that burns and sees in online chat rooms, in dark corners of the web, and sometimes in even in our very own Discord. And that is the topic of virtual dice rolling. More than once. So let's talk about actual dice rolling, first of all. What is everyone's thought about a player that you can't see, that you don't have a webcam with? What is everyone's thought on that person rolling physical dice and then telling you the results? Do you go by trust, or is that something that you don't do? Or what is everyone's thoughts on that, first of all? Rodrigo, let's start with you.
I mean, it just depends on the player and the relationship that you have with that player. If you trust them, then let them do it. If you don't, then don't. But I will say that the good thing about things like Roll20, and actually there's other utilities online that are just for rolling dice that can be accessed by multiple people. So the good thing about those is that if you do have a remote player, you don't need to actually throw the whole, like, do I trust you thing. You can just say, well, everybody who's remote is rolling dice remotely, and then that's that. And if they're the only person, then you can just be like, okay, well, this is what we're doing, so you got to do that.
Okay. Sam, what about you? What is your thoughts on remote players rolling physical dice?
Yeah, I mean, I've done it both ways. I guess, like, the thing is, like, everyone should be in this to have fun. And I know that some people don't find failure fun, and so, like, they might fudge things to, like, make their character always hit. But, like, everyone will notice, and people will comment, and, like, I just think that, like, you're kind of being a jerk if you cheat, and, like, hopefully social pressure is enough. Like, you can definitely get everyone on Roll20 if you prefer to be honest about it. But, you know, I'm also one of those people that thinks that it's okay for a GM to fudge dice on occasion, because sometimes that really suits the narrative. So, like, Rodrigo, and for that matter, me, when I was playing Roll20, rolled everything up front through Roll20 to make it clear what was happening, because that was just kind of the default. But I think it's actually okay for the GM to have a screen and be like, you know, it wouldn't actually be any interesting if, like, my villain misses the entire time in this fight. I'm kind of okay either way, really. It kind of depends on your group and what your priorities are.
Okay, well, let's talk about those virtual dice, Brian. Oh my gosh. So many people just don't trust the virtual dice. Well, and I do get, I swear, I get probably three or four, at least once a quarter, I will get an email from someone going, I can't trust Roll20's dice rolling system because it's weighted in favor of the players, or it's weighted in favor of the GMs. And you can't trust that stuff because never does Roll20 roll below a 10. What are your reactions to, and you come from a computer programming background. Yeah. What are your thoughts on this true randomness of virtual dice?
True randomness is very hard to achieve with digital things. But, I mean, it sounds like they are doing it right, where, you know, the random seed that they do use to generate these random numbers is coming from a truly random source, apparently like the radioactive decay of an isotope. So that's probably going to be more statistically random than actual physical dice, at least many of them. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have seen that whole saltwater test of dice.
Oh, sure, to see if it's balanced correctly, yeah.
Yeah, and how a lot of the, you know, readily available dice on the market aren't so balanced, and so that, you know, can definitely be an issue. People keep an eye out for clear dice, and that lets you see if there are any occlusions in the dice. So if you are using physical dice, that's a good way to kind of help make sure that your dice are good there. I feel like, I mean, if they say they don't get any rolls below 10, they're not hearing me rolling, I guess, on roll 20.
Exactly.
But I feel like it's probably, you know, good enough. I mean, I do tend to prefer having physical aspects, especially if you're in person, so you know everyone can see and be engaged with what's rolling. But no, if I'm going to be playing a game remotely, I'm going to want to go with the digital dice, so it's all on the screen where everyone can see as well.
Yeah, I guess for me, if you trust the application that you're using, like Roll20 and the fact that you're using the decay rate of barium or whatever it is, that seems fairly random, and the chance of it being favor, you know, rolling in favor of the GM or the player or plus 10 or minus 10 or whatever, to me, is not an issue. But how do you overcome that worry of not having physical dice, Matthew? You for years have used physical dice, and then suddenly you were thrust into the world of Roll20, and there are many times where listeners will hear you say, oh, I hate Roll20, and I don't know if that furthered people's fears of Roll20 being a bad dice rolling system or not. But how did you overcome that worry of physical dice versus virtual dice?
Well, when I do, I'll let you know. But I feel like there are a couple of things that you have to take into account. First of all, as with any major spoilers programming, if you hear me say I hate something, it almost certainly means I don't, because there's literally no one on this call that I haven't told that I hate for one reason or another. But more importantly, there's a psychological aspect to gaming. And for me, part of that has been tied to my dice. I'm the guy who has the match set of all red crystal dice. I made sure they're the same color. I have the stupid dice. I have a 30-sider. I have a 100-sider. I have the chip dice. I have the little electronic die that you turn it on and it spins and spins and spins and it actually moves itself. I have a whole bunch of stupid stuff. And for me, that's all been part of the ephemera, part and parcel of playing the game. And giving that up for critical hit in the Roll20 was difficult. Now, at this point, it's second nature, and I don't necessarily worry about it, but I know that I still think when I roll a physical die and it comes up a one, my brain says, I rolled for crap. When I press the button and I type RD20K1563KMG365 Rampart, whatever it is you have to put in, and it comes up a one, I think the game rolled for crap. So I feel like you have to kind of psychologically put yourself in the mindset that regardless of whether you're physically dropping a piece of plastic on a table or you're entering the numbers into the computer, either way, you are creating a random outcome. It's your die, it's your number. And even if that number sucks, it's the same as if you had rolled that die. And you can say all you want, well, this is crazy. This can't happen. In the last round of critical hit, I swear to you, we had a one, four 20s, and another one come up in like six consecutive rolls. And we all called it out and went, wow, that's crazy. But it's also the nature of randomly generating a number between one and 20. And it's hard to remember that sometimes. But just remember, I hate everything and math is nonsense. And you can't really trust either of them.
Well, an important thing that goes with this is like any given person's observation of things, which is not going to be perfect. You know, a lot of the times people are like, oh man, Roll20 is terrible because every time we get into combat, I roll five, it's like the game masters is just rolling nothing but 20s and 19s and 17s. And I'm like, how does Roll20 know you're in combat? Right?
It knows, Rodrigo.
Yeah, it doesn't. I rolled, I want to say in an upcoming episode, maybe it's already out for patrons, I rolled like four ones in a row.
Yeah, you rolled for crap in the last recording session.
Yeah, so it was, that's just, it's something that happens statistically speaking. If you roll a one, the chances of you rolling another one in a 20-sided die are
still one in 20.
So yeah. it's our expectations and our observations of dice that really tend to color that and change the way that we perceive it. I assure you, the machine doesn't know or care what you're doing. It's our expectations of what the machine is like trying to get us to do, I guess, that makes us think that that there's some malfeasance going on.
Yeah.
Well, in our defense, you do in fact have a name in the game when you do something that says the universe, comma, which hates you.
Yeah.
That is literally your Roll 20 game name. So mm-hmm. I'm not saying that you're responsible for our paranoia, but I'm not saying it.
just going back to the macro thing, you can put anything in a macro, including not only the die that you're rolling, but also versus, you know, will or fort or whatever that you're doing. But then you can also put in flavor text in there.
Yes,
as well.
Your macros are hilarious.
So, Matthew, you had said something a minute ago that kind of reminded me that when you were talking about all the crazy stuff that you bring, you know, we have, you know, bags of dice in the Crown Royal bag or one of those critical hit dice bags. We, you know, have 30,000 books that cover the game system that we're playing. Some people want to bring their lucky backpack or their Wormwood dice rolling tray or dice tower and all of those things. And when it comes to the virtual game, you don't have to bring that stuff. So I'm wondering, Sam, what are parts of the game that actually works better when you're playing online compared to in person and vice versa?
So I play a lot of Pathfinder, which is a really complicated system. And looking up rules for that is a huge pain if you're trying to do that with physical books. But it's trivially easy if you're using the SRD, like their resource for all the rules online. And so having everyone have their computer in front of them when they're playing online makes it much easier to be able to make notes, to be able to look up rules. And then, you know, I also honestly like having Google Docs where you have notes with all of like NPC names or quest objectives, basically, or like things that you know about a mystery. And, you know, what having that does also is it protects things. You know, your notes can't have Coke spilled off on them if you're in a Google Doc. You know, your cat can't puke on your book if it's all digital.
Stop puking, cat.
It's definitely happened. It's terrible. you know, so it definitely makes kind of speeds that aspect up. You know, the contrast is that, like, I love looking through physical books for, say, monster ideas, and I'm just never going to get that clear vision of like what a monster looks like just by reading its stat block online.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And then plus also your husband does some really cool things with the Dwarven Forge stuff, right? I mean, those are I think he has Dwarven Forge, but
yeah, Dwarven Forge.
You know, you have Sweet. Those big physical, you know, landscapes and things that you can build to put your adventure in. That may not transfer over virtually, Brian. So what are parts of the game that you think are the hardest to recreate in the virtual space?
Yeah, definitely just any games that rely on other mechanical components like cards or, you know, specific templates can be kind of difficult. I mean, certain platforms do definitely handle it better. I mean, apparently they even got Jenga running and freaking virtual reality, so if you really wanted to play Dread, you could, but I think if you're going to try to play Zombie World, it's going to be a little bit difficult because it is a card-based thing, or like the most recent Paranoia system. I feel like subtlety and nuance is a little bit more difficult in virtual space, because again, you're just relying on audio cues for the most part, not the visual body language. So, you know, games where like players may be trying to be a bit more sly on each other, may not all be working at the same purposes, is probably a little more difficult in a virtual.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a little bit of both, right? It's like, if you want to shoot someone a look, you have to describe it. Even if you are seeing people visually, people won't know that they're the ones you're looking at. So you'll have to be like, my character shoots a look at your character, like, what's going on, right? Whereas in person, you would just do that. But also, there's the whispers feature, where you can actually communicate completely silently and not alert other players as to what you're doing. I will say that if you actually want things to happen, you need to like let your dungeon master in on what you're talking about. Because you can have an entire conversation with another player over whispers, and then when you go and you're like, okay, well, we're going to do that thing, and the game master doesn't know You have to communicate that to them and sort of what your goals and what you're trying to get out of things are. But it's pretty interesting that you can, it's like a net zero, like visual cues are muted, but there's actually a lot of ways to withhold information from other people and transfer information to other people that you wouldn't have physically if you were playing with five people around a table.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Chris asks, Roll20 has a majority share of the market. Do you have any other experience with other virtual tabletops, Fantasy Grounds, or any of the other ones that I listed a moment ago? Rob, you have some experience with some other systems, right?
Yeah. So Brian was mentioning the games with the Jenga or the cards as mechanics. And I was going to say, there's also the tabletop simulator can actually handle both of those things. I don't know how well it'll handle Jenga, but it definitely has the ability to deal out cards and everything like that. It's something that we've been using for other various tabletop games. I haven't done it with role-playing yet, but I don't see any reason why it wouldn't work since it has miniatures built in, snap-to-grid features, and a bajillion variations on mods.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find just about any game that you need, and someone has created a mod for it.
Yeah.
But it allows for a lot more manipulation of 3D elements, whereas something like Roll20, and I've never seen Fantasy Grounds. I'm assuming Fantasy Grounds is going to be similar in the all top-down, just here's our map thing. Dependent, whereas the tabletop simulator, while you do have to purchase it, Steam has sales constantly, and I don't think I paid more than $10 for it.
There you go. Just real quick, before we are out of time this week, I did want to point out that if you're looking for ways to use character sheets that are not inside your virtual game, like we have had mentioned before, Dungeons & Dragons has been pretty good at getting D&D Beyond and Fantasy Grounds and Roll20 to incorporate character sheets that actually work with the system, so that if it'll automatically deduct hit points, or if you click on your spell card, it'll actually roll the dice for you, those kinds of things. But I am a huge fan of Hero Lab for character building. I have two different versions. One is a desktop version on your computer. It has 5th edition of Dungeons & Dragons, 4th edition, Pathfinder. I don't know if it has Pathfinder 2.0, but it's pretty good. It's got a bunch of different systems that you can go in. They also have an online version, which is the Paizo systems, Pathfinder, Starfinder only. Right now, they haven't licensed the D&D system. But what's nice about Hero Lab as far as character sheets, and this is something you might be able to use when you're working with your players, is when it's time to level up, or when you are done, or when you have something that triggers, the system lets you know. So when it's time to level up, you put in and say, oh, I want to use this feat. And it'll say, I'm sorry, you can't use this feat. Or it'll keep track and make sure that you're spending points correctly, or the things are stacking mostly correctly. I just recently went on to the online version of Hero Lab for an upcoming game. And it's pretty good for Starfinder, Pathfinder. I was kind of hoping that they would have had 5th edition and others in there. They don't yet, but the desktop version does. So that's something that you might want to look out for. Also, D&D Beyond apparently has a very robust 5th edition character sheet builder in there for you, as well as NPC character sheet creation tools and those kinds of things. Let's see. Before we get out of here, I think there's one more question. There's a question that popped up here in the chat. Do online games have more or fewer issues with people trying to talk over each other between whisper functions and being unable to see if people are about to talk, or does it just depend on the group? Anyone can jump in on that.
Exactly. Case in point is that you can't, especially when you can't see each other's faces, you can't see when someone's about to talk. And so you're much more likely to have more people like talk at the same time. And especially when like audio is coming in relatively soft from the like remote players, if you have a mix of in-person remote players, it can be really hard to even notice that someone's talking. So you basically have to like make everyone sit down and shut up. Another issue is that, like, sometimes people like to use voices, and sometimes those voices do not translate well over full remote. So if you're like, I'm going to talk in a, like, a soft little voice, people are just not going to be able to hear you.
Mm-hmm. So here's the final question as we end up this week. We've talked about the need to have maybe some kind of a dice rolling system, but not necessarily. You could still use physical dice. You definitely need to have some kind of audio component so that everyone can talk with one another. But if your game is really, and this is what 5th edition really promoted itself as, the theater of the mind combat experience, do you really need a tabletop app at all? Do you really need a Roll20? Do you really need a D&D Beyond? Let's go around the table really quick, Matthew. Start with you and get your reaction to that.
Well, crunchy granola answer. Role-playing games do not need anything other than people willing to role play. You don't need dice. You don't need a gaming system, to be honest. You don't need anything. There is no absolute requirement to play a role playing game other than people who are willing to share that experience and, you know, maybe agree on how that game goes. Will it help? I think yes. But as with so many questions, is it good or bad? It's not necessarily good or bad. It's a question of how much work do you want to put in it? You know, there are times when something will happen and I will try and respond to it as quickly as possible and make it the primary focus. But if I were willing to try and multitask on something, it's just going to make it more difficult. And I think that's the question, is not, do you need it? Is how much extra work are you going to have to do without it? And is that extra work worth it in your particular situation?
Brian?
No, I mean, if you're definitely using a system that doesn't rely so much on miniatures and grid, that can really make things easier if you're just kind of doing a more narrative or even just a more old school game that doesn't care so much about attacks of opportunity. If you're doing like a pre-3E system for D&D specifically, it's definitely can be a lot more suited to that kind of play if you don't want to be clicking on squares so much.
There you go. Rob, final thoughts from you?
Any system that easily supports theater of the mind, totally don't need a virtual tabletop for it. I don't think any version of D&D I've ever played supports theater of the mind all that effectively. But if you're playing so many other systems, it's not necessary to have anything. You may need something so that people can see a little tracker, and that's about it.
Okay, Sam?
I absolutely agree with what Brian said about, like, you know, narrative systems are going to work better for this. Like, one of the weird things about 5e is, as much as it talks about theater of the mind, it still has opportunity attacks, and it still has spells with ranges and areas, and it still has, you know, weapon attacks with ranges and areas. So you kind of really want a grid. And I also really like D. Harshman's point. It's like, you don't need dice or minis, but I do like dice and minis. Like, having a grid just makes me feel way more immersed in the game.
Yep. And Rodrigo, final thoughts from you.
To reiterate, yes, there's a lot of systems out there. You probably don't need any sort of visual thing if you're going to play a Fate Accelerated game. I guess maybe if you're getting into a Cortex game, you probably want to see which way your relationship arrows are pointing. But presumably you can do that in a shared Google document or something like that. I think most games are going to want some sort of core place that everyone can, where the game master can just say, look at this thing. But a lot of games are not going to absolutely need that. You can basically fudge that in a lot of ways. I do think, though, that the majority of games that are out there do want some sort of even very rudimentary tabletop.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for being on the show this week. And thank you to those who were in the live chat during the game during the discussion this month. We certainly do appreciate you showing up as well, and hopefully you found this information valuable. I think the bottom line, when it comes to online gaming, use what works best for you. You don't have to use the same thing that everyone else is using just because they say you have to do it. You can go out and have fun on your own, and hopefully you'll discover something new that soon everyone else will be using, and they'll say that's all because you were the better GM. Thank you so much, everybody, for checking us out this month. We will be back next month with another exciting topic. But until then, here's hoping all of your dice rolls are critical hits.
This podcast is copyright 2019 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.